This is a Day One podcast extra, bringing you an in-depth conversation between our host, Peter Wallace, and a preacher from our half-hour Day One program. For more information about Day One, which brings you outstanding preachers from America's mainline Protestant churches, visit our website at dayone.org.
Welcome to the Day One Podcast Extra. This is Peter Wallace, and with me today is the Reverend Dr. Fred R. Anderson, who fills one of America's great historic Protestant pulpits as the pastor of Madison Avenue Presbyterian Church in New York, New York. Fred, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Peter. It's a privilege to be here.
We talked a bit on the Day One program about your first career as a professional singer, but tell us a little more about that. How did you get started in that, and what sorts of things did you do in that early life?
I've written somewhere that my first vocational crisis happened when I was five. I was trying to figure out whether I was going to be a preacher or whether I was going to be a church musician. And I finally decided I'd be a church musician because it was fairly clear to me they had music that someone else composed and they could work with. And for the life of me, I couldn't figure out how the preacher found all that stuff to talk about. And so it's kind of the coward's way out. I was going to be a musician, so I presented myself to Mrs. Pritchard down the street and began to take piano lessons. I always sang and sang in church choirs and gospel quartets when I was in high school for the Old Youth for Christ movement. We did some traveling up and down the West Coast in Southern California. I had a high school teacher that really took me under his wing and started teaching. And I went off initially planning to pursue a degree in music as some kind of background for either ministry or whatever. I think I alluded to the fact that a huge, huge split in a congregation over a particular pastor's unfaithfulness. My mother happened to be church secretary. My father happened to be chairman of the board of trustees, and fell to my father to have to confront this pastor over his sexual misconduct. Mm. Which he acknowledged, but he said he would deny. And I just, that was it. The church, I said to Jesus, you know, you're still my Lord, but I want nothing to do with your people. Enough of that. Mm-hmm. And so I went off to college to be a singer. And again, just everywhere I turned, had nothing but success and had nothing but encouragement. And so went all the way through college and then was being fast-tracked by a former conductor of an opera house in Germany to go there when draft changed things, and I ended up in the Air Force. But when that was over, back again. Vietnam was in the middle of that. That had its impact on me, but back again and back. Our teacher had gone to San Francisco, so instead of being in New York, we went to San Francisco at the conservatory there. And I was getting back in shape to go sing and audition, go to Europe, and working with these high school kids in that Lakeside Presbyterian Church in San Francisco, California. Be careful what happens, you know, when you do those kinds of things.
But I'm curious because you said at age five you had that inkling that the pastorate might be something for you. What do you attribute that to? Just divine appointment or?
Peter, I've been in the church all my life. My mother and five, I often say, you know, Jesus Christ has been my Lord and Savior as long as I can remember. I used to sit in choir rehearsal. I used to sit in the dark sanctuary, the First Baptist Church in San Bernardino, California, on Thursday nights while the choir was rehearsing. Mm-hmm. And the joke was there was another soprano sitting out in the choir. I was singing along. You know, so from a very early age, I was singing, and it's just always been a part of my life.
Are you still able to engage in singing other than hymns? Or
no. Preaching is, well, several things. Singing at the level that I was singing is very, very particular and very, very hard work.
Rigorous.
It's very rigorous, and you don't do things like stand up in front of people and talk to them for 20 to 30 minutes. It's literally a sung medium.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know how to speak, and you'll hear a lot of that training in what I do, but no, you just knock the line right out. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to sing at that level, and once you've sung at that level, you can't
Yeah.
I remember what it sounded like. And it doesn't sound like that now. I love singing hymns, and for a while would sing in choirs, but I needed to keep my relationship in the church separate. I needed my musicians to be able to be musicians, and I needed to be the pastor. And so, no, I haven't let those things blend over. I've been careful not to go sit in the choir and sing an anthem with them, kind of thing. I've enjoyed rather the whole issue of writing hymns, and that's where that came from.
Well, tell us about that, because your hymns can be found in the Presbyterian Hymnal and many others. How would you characterize the state of music in the church today? There seems to be some great differences about what sorts of music are appropriate for worship. What's your take?
Well, the first thing to say is that the music that's appropriate for a community is the music that's part of their culture. I remember when we were working on the directory for worship, being told about the church out in New Mexico that had the guitar service, but that Western thing was their thing. And so if that's the medium they work in, the medium I've worked in, of course, always is the rather classic church music, both English and German hymnody, and some gospel hymnody. There's some very, very good gospel hymnody. The struggle that's going on in this church, I think, is a foolish one. Jim McCord, who was the president of Princeton Seminary when I was a student, and one of my great teachers, used to talk about the irrelevance of being relevant, that you're so busy trying to be relevant, all you're doing is giving them back their own culture. And some of this struggle about music and praise bands and blended services and all of that kind of stuff, I think it's become very destructive. I watched my own parents struggle through and try to hang in with a church in which their pastor was just convinced they had to go to rock bands, they had to have trap, they had to have all of this stuff to reach young people. The function of hymnody in the church historically, from the time Colossians was written, was to speak of the faith in classic doctrinal ways. Mm-hmm. We learn our faith singing it. I learned a long time ago that people learn far more from the hymns they sing than from the sermons they listen to. And that's, by the way, it's not accidental that most of the great hymn writers in the history of the church have been preachers. Hmm. You know, theologians, people who have wrestled with these ideas and have the gifts to put these images together so they can be sung. I was out in Ohio 2 years ago for a wedding for a parishioner, and the minister there, happened to be a Methodist minister, was lamenting over this struggle. And he said, you know, these praise songs, my father used to call them 7-Elevens. You know, they had seven words and you sang them seven times. He also added they were M&Ms. They sang them to mindless music. So he talked about 7-Elevens being sung to M&Ms. There is, by the way, some very, very helpful and good praise music. Don't let me disparage that. I think the music of Jacques Berthier, the Taizé music, if you want to know what real praise music can be, Taizé, I think, doesn't get any better. In fact, we sing Taizé during communion distribution every Sunday. But this pastor was saying, he happened to be Nazarene, was talking to the Methodist, and he said, are you guys involved in the liturgical renewal movement with hymns? And the Methodist said, well, what do you mean? He said, we're going back and discovering hymns again. He said, we'd been singing praise music for 10 to 15 years and all this exciting. And he said, and we suddenly woke up and realized our people didn't know anything about their faith. And he said, so we have rediscovered hymns because hymns tell us what we believe. I think that's the critical issue. I think the language has to be faithful. It has to be straight praise. And I think the music needs to be the very best of its idiom. If it's going to be rock, it needs to be the very best. If it's going to be folk, it needs to be the very best. If it's going to be a praise idiom, like Taizé, Jacques Berthier's is, I think, the very best.
Well, I'm curious about the process that you personally have in writing a hymn. How do you typically go about it?
Well, it depends on whether I'm writing a hymn or whether I'm metering a psalm. This all began through metering a psalm. Actually, it all began through working with another person's poem. I was chairing the worship committee for the 21st meeting of the World Alliance of Reformed Churches. We were meeting in Ottawa, and the secretary of the church in Taiwan was incarcerated, and they were not letting him out to come, and he had sent a poem on the burning bush. And in the course of all of that, one evening I was looking at this three-stanza poem, and I thought, you know, with a little modification in that language, this could be sung to Yigdal, the god of Abram praise. And so I did it. And then I went off to the German translator, the Spanish translator, the French translator, and they all did the same thing. And so I thought, oh, well, we just wrote our first hymn, didn't think too much about it. My musician in Harrisburg had continued to press me to do some of this, and I was bound and determined not to have a life crisis at 40, and I didn't. Put it off till 41. And it was a significant crisis, and in the midst of that, I remembered something my professor, Bernie, and Bernhard Anderson, professor of Old Testament at Princeton, had said. And of course, he taught on the Psalms, and he said, there's going to come a time in your life when this book is going to be your source of sustenance. Mm-hmm. He says, it'll happen, it'll come, and so I just kind of went back to it and took on a personal discipline of metering a psalm as a personal spiritual discipline. And I'd start on Monday, I'd come and sit down at the desk, and it threw me back into the discipline of daily prayer, which I had abandoned. I know now how I got burned out, but... So I would go back, and I'd work Monday through Thursday, and then I'd put that in the bulletin, and we'd sing it on Sunday. I had learned at a woman's conference at Purdue through a woman named Jane Parker Huber, who was writing new contemporary hymns, that you could write new words to well-known tunes, and people could sing them easily. Right. So I owe a debt to Jane for that. And but so I started metering psalms, and that's how it happened, and... Slowly that pulled me back, and then that caught the eyes of some people just at a time when there was a lot of enthusiasm about psalms. And then the hymnal was going together, and that's how that all got there. So when you're working with a psalm, you've got to stay within the context of what that structure is. And so the trick is to really kind of look for the essence of what that strophe is saying and find a way to do it. And I always let the English translation set whatever the meter is going to be. I usually let the first two lines of a psalm help me figure out what the metrical combinations are going to be. When you're writing a hymn, it's a very different thing. And John Weaver and I have done a number of contemporary hymns. And I said to him, John, give me a tune and I'll write the text. He said, no, Fred. He said, the text always comes first. And so we did a text together for the Myers Park Presbyterian Church. We thank you, Lord, for gift of song. And I just then architecturally broke out what I wanted those three or four stanzas to do. I've learned you can't have five stanza hymns. They're too long. You've got to do it in four. And so then went on and did some things for us, wrote a couple of hymns for communion. One of my favorites, Surely the Lord is in This Place, is a hymn that John and I wrote to commemorate the rededication of a sanctuary after we'd redecorated. We've done a lot of commissions for some people. And so I'll say to them, okay, you want this hymn, the person who's commissioning it, tell me about this person. Tell me about this person's life. Tell me about this person's faith. What's important to them? And so we'll try to lift some of those issues out. So it's just a matter of building the architecture and finding ways to speak truly about God in language that fits well in the mouth. We'll come back to the musical piece. Why this is easy for me is I spent 16, 17 years singing English art song, Italian art song, and German lieder. And so I have a tendency to know what sounds fit well in the mouth and what work well. So I say to kids, you know, God never lets anything be lost. Nothing's ever wasted within the economy of God. All this stuff comes together. So all those years of sitting in studios and memorizing and singing and doing recitals and the like have all come to bear fruit in terms of this hymnody project.
Wonderful. One of the programs that I wanted to ask you about in this conversation is an award for graduating seminarians who exhibit outstanding promise as preachers and scholars. It's in honor of your predecessor, David H.C. Reed.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that.
When David was getting ready to retire, a group of people decided they wanted to honor him. And if you've read David's biography, you know that the most important thing in David's development was a prize he was given between his second and third year when he was a student at Edinburgh. Hmm. Somehow he gave him £300, and he took it in his bicycle and went over and for the next 4 months traveled from Paris to Geneva to Montpellier to Berlin. And he sat in on those classes, and it transformed his life, his theology. And so people knew that. I said, well, maybe we could do something like that. Let's find somebody who shows promise and gift as a preacher scholar. And that's the way they tended to think about David. And I think it's the way David liked most to be thought of. And so find somebody that's going to the parish. We don't want somebody who wants to then go on and get a PhD and teach mm-hmm. preaching at wherever. We want somebody who's going to be in the pulpit proclaiming the gospel, and let's give them a gift. In those days, it was $10,000 with no strings attached to do anything mm-hmm. they want to do with it. And so they developed the David H.C. Reed Preacher Scholar Award, and every year since 1991, we have a series of students who apply for this. They must submit a sermon on an Old Testament text, a sermon on a New Testament text. They must submit a brief exegetical paper that demonstrates their ability to work with the text so that it's scholarly. They need to submit their curriculum vitaes, their transcripts. We want to see what they've studied. It's not just somebody who's a gifted preacher. It's this whole package. And we also ask them what they'll do with it. Mm. And the hint is use it for some kind of life-changing experience that otherwise you couldn't have. And then we have a committee of 16 people at church that go through all of those. We get about 35, 40 applications. Mm. So that means 80 sermons have to be listened to and read and whatever. And they work together and they boil that down to a group of 4, maybe 5. And then I have a group of fellow pastors in New York City. There are a group of us that get together about once a month just to support one another. Representing some of the significant congregations in New York City, and they become the finalist judges. Hmm. And we listen to them. Those sermons have to be preached, by the way. It's mm-hmm. not just read. They mm-hmm. have to. We have to listen to them be preached live, because preaching, that's what's so exciting about this. It's not about reading. It's doing mm-hmm. it. And then we decide. And this last year, we changed the rules and decided to give Jessica Tate, who came from Union Richmond, who was a marvelous preacher. And she was shocked when we said, not only told her she'd won, but that it's a $20,000 prize now. And the runners-up are each given $1,000. Hmm. So every year. And we're receiving applications for that. So all they have to do is get online and at the church's homepage, and they'll find the information.
Which is MAPC?
It's www.mapc.com.
Wonderful. What a great program.
Really exciting. And it's just taken off. It's a lot of fun to work with.
Fred, thanks so much for talking with us.
You're very welcome.